Hi, I'm Steve, and I'm an engineer.
And I'm Mac, a history teacher.
Welcome to Civics on the Rocks, the once-a-month podcast out of Texas.
In this podcast, we, along with our producer, Anne...
Hello.
...talk about politics, history, and science.
And science fiction.
We're also drinking.
Yes, lots of drinking, and bad jokes.
Not distasteful.
Just poor quality.
Okay, let's get started. Question of the day, what's an acre?
Acre is a unit of measure of area.
It is.
Typically applied for land.
Yes.
Just to set the stage for people who don't actually work in like surveying parlance on a regular basis.
The thing that always bugged me about an acre, because as a kid, you know, somebody would say, oh, that's about an acre. And I'm like, that doesn't tell me anything. I don't know. It's like, okay, whole bunch of land over there. It's about an acre. And so I try to look it up.
Acre's yay big.
So I look, right. Out yonder.
Yeah.
Unit of distance. So an acre is 4,840 square feet. And I quickly realized that's not a square of anything. It's not like 400 feet square, 300 feet square, whatever. And so I'm like, what the hell is it? So come to find out, it is a chain by a furlong.
Which is obvious to anyone, really.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, duh, what right? That's what we learned in school. So a chain... This is where you have units of measure that are not only convenient for the measurement of the land or whatever, but also convenient for like the surveyor's tools. Yeah. A chain is 66 feet and it's made up of 100 links and each link is almost 8 inches. And it's like, where the hell did this come from? Literally, it was a guy in England in 1620. I think his name was Gunter. who sort of, no, like I'm not making that up.
Because like it sounds like complete bullshit.
No, I know. And I'm good at that, but this is not that. It's Edmund Gunter in 1620. I mean, don't we know this? That sort of standardized. And so that became, so a chain is 66. And then 10 chains is a furlong.
So a chain is only 66
feet. Yeah.
Because it has 100
links.
And each link is approximately...
8 inches, almost.
Almost 8 inches.
Okay. So they went for... The round number there is the number of links,
yep.
Not the size of the link.
Correct.
Nor how many would make the chain.
Well, but you'll find a lot of this...
No, it's 100 links in a chain.
It's 100 links in a chain.
Right, but the length of the chain is 66 feet.
Yeah.
Not because anybody wanted 66, so, because 100 was nice. But I'll bet you it's also because 100 links on a chain of that material was something you could carry, and it wasn't too bad.
Was okay, weight-wise,
yeah, you could have done 200, but that had been really heavy, and you couldn't carry that around the land and survey things.
And so, the other thing about this is because, like, an acre was always regarded as roughly speaking, as an estimate, about the amount of land that one man could plow in a day. Okay, but think about this, if it's like... a chain by a furlong, and a furlong is 10 chains, you've got a really elongated rectangle. And that kind of makes sense because if you're plowing, you don't want to spend a lot of time turning around.
Yeah.
And so you'll go for longer and have fewer things. And
also for the record, so then it's technically 100 square chains. Or 10 square, right? Because it's 1 by 10? 1 by 10
yeah.
Chains?
Yeah.
So it's 10 square chains.
10 square chains, yes.
Yeah.
So why isn't chain like the unit of measure instead of feet? Like, why aren't we doing things links and chains?
It was, but at some point we no longer needed to worry about it. I'm guessing when we have, you know, tractors and whatever. So it became more a matter of convenience to divide up parcels of land by just their size. And it's like, you know, okay, you know, Bob, your swath of land goes to the river instead of like having these elongated rectangles.
Texas, when you measure using veras.
Yes.
What's because
vera?
Vera.
Yeah. Spanish unit of measure, the vera, V-E-R-A.
Okay. Yeah. It's actually some Texas property law, it incorporates Spanish from when the land was originally, well, taken from the indigenous people.
From back when it was Spanish.
Yeah. And so you can still define, like, parcels of land or whatever in vetas. Or you go far back how enough and you find...
Veta?
That's about yay big.
I forget, yeah.
Is it V-E-R-A?
Yeah.
V-E-R-A. I want to say it's comparable to a yard-ish. It's in that scale. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's not a chain.
I mean, I know according to the Daughters of the Alamo, there are still people that have their land contracts from the Spanish government from when they moved to Texas. Sure. But so that's why it's still in use in Texas, because...
Yeah. Because basically Stephen F. Austin and that crew, when they started landing and colonizing it and taking it over from Spain, Mexico, everything was set up in vetas because that's what Spain used. Because
that's what they did, yeah.
Obviously.
Can you colonize colonizers?
Sure.
Yeah, we're humans.
Yeah. Can you take someone's land and claim it as your own? Yes, yes you can.
Well, no, and even when they took somebody's land? Yeah. Like, didn't they actually come and buy the land from the Spanish government?
Yes.
So that's not really...
No. Yeah. Because originally it was when Mexico was still controlled by Spain.
Oh.
But during that time...
I'm going to say something wrong. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah, no. During the time... And I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Did you not grow up in Texas and take Texas history?
I did. I just can't remember.
Come on, dude. Mexican it goes along with the tour of the Buttercrust Bakery and the... Anyway.
I didn't do that.
Anyway, back to Vetus.
Units of measure.
Yeah.
So... Well,
okay. Yeah.
Let's not say ridiculous units of measure. Don't be judgy. Just units of measure.
But we're still using acres now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to buy a house, they're going to say it's, you know, on 1.2 acres. Actually,
the lot size, I don't know that it's going to be expressed in terms of Lakers. Lakers, wow. Acres. Not sorry.
They like lay basketball players down.
Lakers are varying length. So... And they found that inconvenient.
Still wouldn't reach a championship. Anyway, but I was going to say like length and acre came out, but I think plots of land are often described not by the area, but by the length of what they're bounded by. It's generally
more convenient for residential properties to describe the parcel in terms of length and width.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 60 by 140 or whatever it is.
And that's feet.
That's feet. Now, you go into modern survey records when they're surveying any kind of parcel, and that's what they're going to do. The surveyor is going to basically draw the outline. He's going to survey the boundary of the property, and he's going to survey it using feet. From point 1 to point 2 is so many feet in such a direction. And then from that point, I went some other distance in some other direction. And eventually I went all the way around the property. But when they calculate the area, they'll usually do acres, because you end up with something ridiculous like 68,512 square feet, which is nobody likes large numbers.
And it's just easier to express it in acres.
Yeah, so they just say, that's 120 acres or whatever.
So they divide it by 4,000, whatever.
Yep.
Which, can anybody remember that? Can you remember that?
No, already? I had it wrong earlier. So, yeah, I thought it was something else when I had...
No, and I had just conversion. Looked... I literally had to look it up. And this is like the fourth or fifth time in my life I've looked up to see what it exactly is.
I mean, I can tell you all sorts of other kind of conversions off the top of my head. Like, for instance, there's 7.48 gallons per cubic foot. There's 62.3 pounds per cubic foot of water.
So I'm just going to say this. Doesn't this seem really stupid?
Why?
No.
Like, honestly, because it just... Metric system. I would like to bring in the metric system.
Okay.
Okay, but before we go metric, let's take a moment.
Because you know I'm going to fight.
If I may. And go back to why we're supposed to be here, which is civics.
Yeah.
And talk about why measurement has to do with civics before we have a metric throwdown.
So we do, because we are going to have the metric throwdown.
Well, I think this is civics, because why wouldn't we switch to something that's simple, easy, and done by the rest of the world, except we're stubborn and it's hard to change things in the U.S.
But let's...
Have you ever been on a British road and seen them measure things in yards?
Well, I don't...
Yeah, so we're not the only place that's stubborn.
Okay, but do we want to be like Britain?
Can we avoid being like Britain? Really?
I mean, we kind of like made a whole fuss about it a few years ago.
We did.
We were very like, no, we don't want to be like Britain.
That's true.
Let's not be Britain.
That's true, but that was very much like the whiny adolescent wanting to leave home. God, and then you find out you're just like your parents anyway, and so they're the only people you hang out with.
Yeah, I remember when the Second Continental Congress said, we're going to drive on the right side of the road.
Yeah. Dang it.
Yeah, so before we get into the metric system and why it's wrong, so the civics aspect of it, is it's important to have standards of weights and measure, primarily for commerce. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, for convenience, for things like science, definitely. But
that's just a bonus.
That was actually not a laugh track line. I mean, that was, you know, I meant that anyway. But you know, commerce is important. But like, think about this:
is commerce more important than science?
Well, okay. Well, do you want to be able to eat?
I would think science actually contributed to that. Actually,
well, think about how science contributes to our food, and is that really
well? But more to the point, back in 7-odd whatever, yeah, there was science, but it was kind of hobbyist stuff. What was important was figuring out how much land you had, how many bushels of whatever you were growing on the land, what price you could get for it at market, and how that was getting the people to feed them.
Man, you do are Capricorns. Science.
And figuring out, well, that's the truth.
Yeah, not long, but.
But yeah, but no, I mean, like acre, figuring out about how much land a person could plow in a day. I mean, that's a measurement based on humans. That's a
bullshit measurement.
No, but it's based on humans.
They did not go and watch six guys plow their fields and time them.
Really?
And then, like, no, they didn't. They didn't go find 100 and,
why did they need to?
500 guys and collect the data and measure it. And
but they didn't need to.
Yeah, they didn't need to. They didn't need to.
No, some guy went like, oh, it's about this.
Yeah. How much grain do we need? You know what? Enough.
The chain's this long, so I guess it'll be that one side.
Yep.
No, it's all made up.
All the measurements are made up.
And arbitrary and for convenience.
Convenience
of who?
It is our application of some standards to get a better handle on the natural universe.
But what I'm saying is like our standards are very silly.
Okay, but I'm gonna say no.
Well, hold on.
Because
before we get into the good versus bad standards, let's go back to the civics. The civics part, yeah. And just tie that
before, because we're chomping at the bit for the metric fight. So again, the important thing is, among other things, is standardized weights and measures for purposes of commerce, also purposes of science, but.
And think, even like conversation, to understand that when you're talking about a unit of measure, we're all talking about the same thing.
Yes.
Whether that be in commerce or science or whatever.
So a long time ago, I looked up to see exactly what a cubit was. That's what I do.
Do we use cubits?
Well, okay, that's not the point. I mean, yes, it's a historical unit of measure, but I was always taught that it was basically the distance between the tip of your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. And for most human beings, that's about the same, regardless of your relative height or size. Even with that, when you had some cubits that got standardized, there were some that turned out to be like 15 inches. I want to say a Roman cubit was like 20 or 21 inches. And so even then, you have these discrepancies. But especially if you want to have trade between different societies, mm-hmm. and what you want to have some standardization, so that when you trade and barter or you purchase things for gold or whatever, it facilitates commerce, and then facilitates exploration of the natural world, because it gives you a formal way in which to express things.
Yeah, and so it's when you're trying to standardize something. A great way to do that is if you have your government, whatever government that is, whether that's a dictatorship or a democracy or something else in the middle, they can impose that standard across everybody. So we're all agreeing that we're using whatever we're using, whether that be cubits or acres or furlongs or meters or what have you.
And in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 gives Congress the power to set standards for weights and measures.
So they set whatever standard we wish them to set. And it's important that we have a standard because it just makes things work.
It's been recognized as a really important function of government to set standards of weights and measure to facilitate all of this. But it's one of those things we don't actively think about, because it's like, how many people, other than people like us, think about why is a foot a foot? Why is an acre? You know, why is a parsec a parsec?
Why don't we use the metric system?
So let's get into that.
Okay.
And I want to make this observation that a lot of the imperial / U.S. standard units, they're based on human beings somehow. You know, the idea of an inch being the distance between this joint and your knuckle or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the idea of an acre being about what a person could plow in a day. It doesn't matter where in the universe we go. those measurements, whether we're talking about distance, area, weight, mass, they're going to have some relevance for us because we're human beings. We're human beings on an exoplanet 43 light years away. We can still use those units of measurements for our, because they're going to have some human connection. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, people is like, how much is a pound? Well, a pound is like about what you can hold comfortably in your hand, yeah. You know? And
sorry, but that humans are so variable, and the idea that we're standardizing and basing units of measure off of them is ridiculous.
The idea that we base a meter until about 20 years ago off of the length of one platinum bar in France is kind of ridiculous.
Although,
is it? Because the platinum bar in France doesn't change.
Yes, it does.
Like, if you pick everything one thing changes. You stick with it.
It changes.
It's Schrodinger's platinum bar.
And if the thing you pick happened to be somebody's arbitrary measurement of somebody's, you know, inch, foot, whatever, cubic, and then you stick with it, whatever you start with is always arbitrary.
Whose foot?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. It's just arbitrary. Like right now, they used to have the meter be defined as that one platinum bar, which was like under three different bell jars in a vacuum so that it wouldn't lose things. Right. And they had to measure it at a certain temperature because it thermally expanded, and they had to replace it, and there were duplicates, and it was a whole thing. They said, no, this is crazy because it's a platinum bar. Why would we do this? So instead, they went and made it some not even integer multiple of the wavelength of cesium in a vacuum, because we all use cesium in a vacuum.
And you know, that's kind of how they defined a second, right? Well, wasn't it like the vibrations of a cesium atom or something or whatever? So of course. That's what I got on my watch.
Yeah, they were able to bring, I think maybe there's still one or two fundamental units short of bringing them all to some universal constant.
Of cesium, apparently.
But that's the thing. It's like, it's this arbitrary number based on some universal constant, which is in theory unchanging, but it's picked to line up with this random arbitrary thing somebody picked
once. That we had already come up with.
Yes, yes.
It's an object, I don't know. To me, that makes much more sense than, hey, everybody's foot.
Well, and I don't know that the actual original definition of a foot was like, this is about the length of a foot, because I don't know anybody's foot that's a foot long.
Yeah.
I think maybe it was Subway.
Well, it tended to be body parts. No, I'm going to move past that.
Laugh at that joke. No. That was awful.
That was okay. Bad. No, I mean, it was always arbitrary and convenient, so it usually was body parts that were roughly the same, but they were never consistent. So it was always kind of George's versus Fred's.
But it allows you to be close enough, especially when you're peasants.
Yeah.
And you have to live everything rough anyway. I mean, you don't have like standardized tools.
I mean, it's plus or minus, say, 20%, but at least then you're within 20%. It's close. And it's convenient. You can carry it with you. You don't have to check to see if your meter stick had been verified recently.
For inventing said measurement, I kind of get your point. But right now, there's two big units, systems of measurement out in the world, right?
Two big units?
Yes, I said big units. So there's these two main systems, right? Standard and metric.
Most commonly used, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say standard. I'd say, U.S. Imperial. But yeah, go ahead.
U.S. Imperial and metric. The vast majority of people use which?
Metric.
Oh, use metric for some of their measurements.
Right. Yes. So by all of your arguments that you made earlier about how we need to do commerce and we need to be able to communicate with other cultures and be able to like make things flow easily, why aren't we using metric?
We seem to be managing. And because we use metric.
And calculators.
There are certain things where we do use metric, like NASA, all of NASA's contract. It's like it specifies military. You got to use metric.
All the artillery shells forever have been measured in millimeters.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, But also things like, why don't we use metric time if we use metric everything else?
They tried that.
It sucked.
It did not work.
Because
when
it wasn't...
When
they first came up with the metric. Early 1800s.
Yeah. When they first came up with metric, when they were doing this, let's have this glorious abstracted...
Like 10-hour...
Intellectually 10-hour day. Based measurement, everything... And here's what length will be, here's what weight will be, here what everything else will be, and here's what a day looks like. Off. And it screwed everybody else from the get-go because it was nowhere near what they were used to doing on a day-to-day basis. So to get along in their lives, basically they dropped it.
Yeah, and they reverted to the sexagesimal system for minutes and hours.
Yeah, which is even more ridiculous.
And then 24 hours in a day.
So,
But I want to ask this question about a meter, because the original definition of a kilometer is 1/10,000th of the distance between the pole and the equator. between one of the poles in the equator?
I believe so, yeah.
And so a meter is 1,000 kilometers.
That, yeah.
So you have this unit of measure that's based very specifically on our planet.
Yep.
Doesn't that seem ridiculous to you?
Mm-hmm. It's as ridiculous as any other unit of measure.
So you're just anti-measure.
No, I think we have to embrace the fact that any measurement system we use is inherently arbitrary and inconsistent. The one thing metric has an advantage to over our other units of measure is that it's more easily convertible between units.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because
you move a decimal point.
But it was also thought from the beginning, okay, how we're going to make these things interconvertible mm-hmm. and of similar scale. And it kind of sort of works out. Now, what's funny is they don't use all the ones they come up with. Like, when did somebody measure anything in a decimeter?
That's exactly
nobody what uses that. Decimeter or decameter.
Do you know what?
Why? I don't know. They go from meter to kilometer.
Do you know what a cubic decimeter is called?
It should be a liter.
It is. Yeah. That's one of liters.
But that's what's funny is it's not a cubic meter is a liter. No.
It's a cubic decimeter.
Yeah, decimeter is a liter.
Tenth of a meter.
Because why? Because liter was more convenient for day-to-day use because it's about yay big.
Yeah. And that's like, why is a pound a pound? You know, at some point, fundamentally, because it's what you can sort of hold comfortably in your hand.
Well, and can we talk
that's about a pound.
Let's talk about metric temperature.
Yes. Well, temperatures are all stupid.
Yeah, no, they are. Well, no, they're all equally unstupid, which also means they're equally stupid. So, you know, Fahrenheit was, as I recall, it was how cold can we get something when we came up with the scale, which was ice plus salt, which gets down to about zero. That's a nice peg on one end of the scale. What's a nice warm thing we have on hand? Oh, let's do human body temperature. Sadly, the guy had a fever. So there you 100. Go. Awesome. Okay, crap. We realize 150 years later, we screwed up. Let's do the same thing with Celsius this time, but be a little smarter about stuff. We're just going to say when ice freezes.
Is zero.
Okay, fine.
When of course, water boils.
We're saying freezes at sea level.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, pure water. There's a bunch of caveats and asterisks and footnotes on that one. And then when does it boil? 100. Okay, cool.
100, yeah.
At sea level, pure water. Yeah. So there's a bunch of other, you know, contextual caveats, but it's all based on water. Okay, fine. You know, and 1 gram is 1 cubic centimeter of water. You know, so there's some nice interchangeability, especially for the chemists in the room. You know, that's handy.
But the thing about Fahrenheit is it's like when the outside temperature is about what my inside temperature is, it's pretty damn uncomfortable. And that just becomes a convenient, yep. Oh, it's like 100 degrees.
Yep.
And
I don't want to be out in that.
Yeah.
Also, what I like though is they picked those and they were both. Every day, 0 and 100 were everyday points of reference, mm-hmm. which is great. And then the scientists realized, well, wait, crap gets colder than 0. What do we do? Well, we'll just have negatives. How negative? Negative enough.
And then we have Kelvins.
Well, yeah. So then you have Kelvins and Rankine. So now you go down to 273.15 negative Celsius is absolute 0, minus 459.67, I think. Fahrenheit is absolute 0 in Rankine.
Actually, so that means zero wait, I hadn't thought about this.
Zero in Kelvin.
There's no negative Kelvins.
No, you can't have negative Kelvin or negative Rankine.
That's the whole point it's of not Kelvin. A
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And I mean that's
but
obvious. But I just never thought about it.
But it's kind of funny too because it's like why you can still do the calculations with negative numbers, but sure. They decided they didn't like it, so they had to
make
a new unit of measure just to get rid of negatives because I don't know.
If we're good, I'm tired and I don't want to talk about this anymore.
So, wait.
Okay.
So I do want to say, again, I want to revisit the meter being a unit of measure derived somewhat arbitrarily from being very Earth-specific.
But everything is arbitrary and Earth-specific.
Yep.
But why are we going to argue that the metric system is so much better when it, like other things...
Because we already said that it's easier to convert.
I will go actually
because
with,
it's just
with,
on base
with Anne's one argument.
Right, but that's easier to convert than
I'll go with the imperial system. That more so people use that arbitrary system.
And more people use it.
So.
So why are we the holdouts? Because we're America?
Because we couldn't, because of kilometers, we couldn't get the kilometers.
So can I mention randomly a story from my thing a while back, the whole How to Hide an Empire, where, you know, basically the U.S. forced the rest of the world to change things like the pitch of sea and how to angle threads and bolts, because we did it different than them. But they were kind of an economic shambles after World War II, so they caved.
Well, and that's why all the airports in the world speak English and French.
Or French, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but mostly English, really.
Yeah, mostly English.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I get, like, we had Big Stick. We made them do our way. But, well, one.
It was, no, it, okay, I'm going to argue it wasn't just Big Stick, per se. It was the fact that in the 40s, 50s, who was around making all the planes and manning all the airports? It was vast majority were Americans because we'd scattered ourselves all across the world fighting this war. And we set up bases and we started running things. And when the locals said, hey, that's a cool thing. I want one too. They're like, cool, sure. We'll show you how to run it.
Here's a C-47.
I don't know how to talk to you. Can you learn English? Because I don't know how to speak whatever.
Because why would we learn how to speak whatever?
Yeah, yeah. So not saying there wasn't some hegemony going on there, but it wasn't exactly a stick. It was more like, we got all the planes. You want to use them? Fine, but we can't translate all our crap into 1,400 languages. Just learn English. Right.
So again, that goes back to your, because this is a fact that why do languages die out? It's usually commerce. It's usually because they're having to communicate with a bigger nation to sell stuff, and so they convert to that language. No, it's true.
Well, yeah, I commerce seems overly simplified. It's not just commerce, it's also other forms of exchange, but sure. Okay.
Yes. But why did they get there? Why did they colonize the place in the first place? For money, for some sort of
power. Well, usually commodities that they wanted to control,
which is commerce.
Yeah.
So, anyways, that's why languages die out. But let's get back to the metric system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is using it except for us and England. And correct. We've already established England as a small little island now. They're no longer an empire. Who cares?
So you're saying we should conform to things just because everybody else is doing
them? And you said that earlier. And that was your argument earlier for why measurements were standardized.
So you're saying that we should conform because everybody else is doing it. So why are we not
standardizing when it was so cool before for everybody to do it with a foot and an acre? So, why isn't it cool for us to do it?
Because it's still based on a certain amount of humanity, you know, like human proportions.
I'm just confused as to why you want the language of U.S. measurement to die out.
Because I don't like it. It's easier to convert.
You're metric. Talking about, like, you want to be able to just move a decimal point over.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, because it's not like the other one's easier. Dividing by 12
or 3 or whatever. Yeah,
or trying to look up what the number is you're supposed to divide by.
Well, you're not doing it enough. That's why I know things like how many gallons in a cubic foot.
Right, but in the metric system, I literally just have to look at the word and I can figure it out.
Yes, that's true. No, the math is easier with metric.
They're both completely arbitrary. We have established this. You two have convinced me. One is easier to do the math when converting. Yes. Okay. So that seems like the better system to go.
Okay. So let me put this put it this way. If you're saying, am I suggesting that NASA go back to using, you know, yards, miles, and foot pounds for things? No.
For lungs?
For what? Yes. Can you imagine, like, watching a shuttle launch and it's like, the shuttle is now 2,860 furlongs downrange?
It's nautical miles.
Oh, yeah. By the way, let's talk about that. Nautical mile. Do you know what a nautical mile is?
Not even a mile.
It's, what is it, an arc second of... It comes out to about 6,080 feet.
It's even more.
But it's like, but you divide up, so the globe is 360 degrees. The actual physical circumference is about 24,000.
I'm going to jump ahead to knots.
Yeah,
which is how we measure airspeed in knots, because they used it in ships.
Because you're going over oceans and continents.
I like how you say that with, like, well, this will explain it, and now they will understand.
No, because we had this unit of measure.
And why don't you?
That was dumb and was ocean bound, and now that we have a thing in a completely different medium of transport, we said, you know what it's we should use?
Dumb.
Let's use the ocean measurement for
because
speed.
Because it is intercontinental travel.
So is the railroad, and they don't measure its speed in knots.
No. Drops mic. Okay, look. Look here.
Cocktail break.
So the cocktail this evening was a black velvet.
That's correct.
which I'm introducing it, but I didn't make it. So, Anne?
So, I was at a bar one time on St. Patrick's Day, and the bartender said, "Do you want to try black velvet?" And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Guinness and champagne." And I started to laugh at him. He's like, "No, trust me." I was like, "Okay, I'll try that." And it is now one of my favorite drinks. And every St. Patrick's Day, I buy Guinness and I buy champagne and I make black velvets. And yeah, it's about half and half the way I make them. I don't know if that's how they make them at the bars, but it's essentially a black and tan, but instead of using a light Irish beer to go with your dark Irish beer, you're using a sparkling wine. And
well, and in terms of being half and half, I don't know that there's a standard unit of measure for black velvets.
I think half and half is a proportion. There's not a unit of measure. You're fine.
But in any case, I'm going to say the way that you made them, perfect.
Yep.
I've had them before. It's been a long time. I kind of forgot just how awesome they are.
They're in that neat category of cocktails where you end up with something different than you started with.
Yeah.
And a lot of cocktails are, "Oh, you flavored this liquor very nicely. Thank you very much." This is one of those where, like, no, this is something new and different.
And kind of like the X-Men from the last episode with the peach schnapps and the, because it's like not expecting that to be that refreshing. And really, I mean, it was cool.
I kept looking at my glass to remind myself that there was Guinness there.
Now, I will say the other thing that I do remember about black velvets is I need to stop at one.
Yeah, they do pack a punch.
Yeah.
And it's one of those subtle, well, I find that with Guinness anyways, because Guinness, you're like, you're just having a nice time. You're slowly sipping on this very delightfully complex beverage. And you think, oh yeah, I can totally have a second one. And then partway into that second one, you're like, oh, I should not have done that. And you start questioning life choices.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is really magical. And it's like, I can taste all the lovely parts of the champagne that I like, and I can't taste the parts of the champagne that I don't. And the Guinness is there, but somehow very well, very tempered, not hidden by any means, but very complimentary, not anything that makes any sense.
Yeah. And I like, one of the things that I almost wanted to do this evening is I just called out, and I'm sure there's a name for this. I want to call them Irish Boilermakers. I would drink them in college, where instead of like just a shot of whiskey, like bourbon in a beer, it was specifically a shot of Irish whiskey in a Guinness. But at the time, the Guinness was not the Guinness, the draft Guinness that you can get in the cans, which is what we've got. It was the extra stout. And yeah, I'm not going to do that. And this is good, though. This is good. The black velvet.
This is quite tasty.
There's a lot of variations on the mixing of Guinness with stuff. And I think because it is such a sturdy.
It is pretty sturdy.
It holds
stocky
up.
If you will.
Beer, I guess technically it's a beer. But yeah, it's
it is so not legally a milkshake.
But yeah, so at the Renaissance Festival outside of Houston, they have a lot of variations where it's like the bee sting, which is Guinness and mead.
Okay.
Yeah. There was one that was Guinness and hard apple cider, but I forget what they called that one.
Crap. That would have been, I like hard apple cider is fine. I like that and Guinness, but like, I can't imagine the two of those. Was it really?
Cause I got it cause it was like, I didn't think a black velvet would work. So I tried it. It's sweet. So it's almost like a dessert, but,
Guinness itself is almost like a dessert.
I mean, I can't imagine mead and Guinness. I wouldn't go there, but
I could probably see that actually.
But yeah, it's something about Guinness. It's just like, yeah, put something in it. It's still gonna be Guinness.
Yeah.
And that's the nice thing with the champagne, because you can, I mean, the champagne is there.
Yeah, it's there.
And the Guinness is there, but like you said, it's like something totally new.
Yeah. Alchemical kind of thing.
Yeah. It's a rogue wave of cocktails. The sum is greater than the parts.
Now it's time for What's That Over There?
Squirrel! So for me, the thing I've been reading recently, which has been catching my eye, other than my normal staple of law-oriented podcasts, is a bunch of Ray Bradbury.
Nice.
I realized I was underread in my classic sci-fi. I like my kind of 60s, 70s sci-fi. I've read a lot of that in my years, but like the immediately prior period, the foundational type stuff. Yeah, I was like, no, I really haven't. And so I've read Illustrated Man, and I read, I'm currently reading Martian Chronicles. And I got to say, Martian Chronicles, and I'm only a bit into it, it's trippy.
Yes, it is. It is
messed up. And it's like, what? Yeah. So, good stuff. It, so.
It's, well, and I don't want to, I mean, but I had never read, I'd really never read Ray Bradbury. Mm-hmm. We had to read Dandelion Wine in high school, of all things. And I was like, yeah, okay. I had a former student recommend The Illustrated Man. And I read that, and I'm like, holy shit. This is, well, and for one thing, not realizing that so many, like Illustrated Man, well, not Illustrated Man. No, yeah, Illustrated Man, Martian Chronicles, their collection of short stories.
Yes.
And like for Asimov, iRobot, I didn't realize it's a collection. And they're all the robot things are a collection of short stories.
Well, it's kind of fun. Yes, although I will say, like, Illustrated Man is a collection of short stories.
Yeah.
Period. iRobot is a collection of short stories, novellas, but like on a theme.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's,
well, and some of the same characters because they're
and kind of like Martian Chronicles. I'm like, it's the series of vignettes.
Yes.
Really. And
it's again, like snapshots of these.
There's
events.
A story. Yeah. Yeah. But it's told as a series of vignettes, not as a novel, but not as disjointed as short stories.
Well, and for that matter, like Heinlein's Future History Stories, it's, Bradbury is really good at short stories.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's where he made his money.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, like, Asimov has the short stories and Heinlein has the short, but Ray Bradbury is, like, so good at short stories.
Yeah, Illustrated Man was just impeccable. I mean, when it came to, like, the themes and the kinds of short stories and the structures of them, and it just, you're like, oh, yeah, no, you were, yes, this is what it all kind of came from. You can see so much coming out of these.
Yeah,
it was really, really.
And cool. I actually, this is one of those books that I sort of started to read, stuck a bookmark in, and I'll come. Is a collection of short stories by him called The October Country, which is more of the almost like Twilight Zone-y, like, I mean, sort of sci-fi, but just more like a little darker.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are really good. I love Ray Bradbury. Yeah, I'm reading about Nazis
again.
Yeah. No, this is the Operation Paperclip book, which is by Annie Jacobson. I mentioned Annie Jacobson before in the Area 51. So she's got this book about...
Zero Danny Jacobson in a row.
Yeah. And it's probably the fifth book I've read by her, and I'm sort of on an Annie Jacobson kick. And again, you know, same thing. It's incredibly well-sourced. She looks at primary source documents, including a lot of stuff that was like declassified around the same, like things were declassified in like 2010, 2011, 2012. She dives into it and, you know, and puts all this together. And yeah, she sourced it from things that people had already written about Operation Paperclip, where we get some of the German scientists and they come work for us. And that's the most, least of it, you know. Of,
but
yeah. And, but she's also looking at primary source documents that were declassified, some of which she got declassified through like FOIAs. And it is a little horrific in some of the German scientists we got, who we were like, we just decided in the immediate aftermath of World War II and even seeing the evidence of the Holocaust, we're like,
we want rockets.
Well, it's more like, we need these guys so that the Russians don't have them. Mm-hmm. And it's not rockets is almost the least of it. It's also about chemical and biological weapons.
Yeah.
And it's like, God. And so I've taken a break from it, and I'm reading something about the Titanic to have something a little lighter. You know, I mean, it's just,
it sank.
Yeah. And so, no, I just started, about the Titanic, I just started Night to Remember by Walter Lord, which was made into the movie in 1958, which I'm going to say, if you're going to see a Titanic movie, you got to see A Night to Remember. Because that's the movie you need to see.
That's not the one everybody references. You're reading a really old book about the Titanic.
Yes.
Because they've discovered some stuff since
then. No, I know. Yeah. So when Walter Lord wrote the book, everybody still thought that the iceberg cut a gash through the steel of the Titanic. But, you know, when you think about that, it's like, then that thing would not have taken 2.5 hours to sink. It would have just gone globe. Okay. And we now know that, like, the impact of the iceberg and the lower quality steel that had too high of a sulfur content popped rivets, popped plates, and so the water starts leaking in, but it starts leaking in 1,000 different places. And that's what, we know that. Mm-hmm. And so, but yeah, I mean, it's still during the time, but he's still telling the stories of, you know, some of the people who were on the Titanic. Like I was talking about the book by Annie Jacobson, Operation Paperclip, which is about more in there. What was more of the, is like, there were a lot more of those guys that were coming in that were like bioweapons and chemical weapons and stuff that we needed that information. And it was so bleak. I'm not surprised. Yeah. That I was like, hey, let me lighten up and read something about the Titanic.
It was an interesting time though, because it was kind of one of those, sort of like the atomic bomb. Like, they didn't just build the atomic bomb because they wanted the atomic bomb. They built the atomic bomb because they were scared to shit the Nazis were going to have one.
Yeah.
So you have this weird, if we don't build it, then they're going to build it, and we're in deep shit.
Yeah.
Kind of like the, well, if we don't get the scientists, the Soviets are going to get the scientists, and that's not good.
But then there's also, like, if we build it, it's going to get used somewhere.
Yeah, no.
And here's another thing, like, if we, and this gets into the whole, like, if we had invaded Japan, mm-hmm. you know, whether we dropped the atomic bombs or not, and they were still fighting or whatever, that we had stockpiled chemical weapons. Now, there is an argument to be made that we would probably not have used them because FDR was sort of, there is some indication he would not have wanted to use them, and maybe Truman would have felt the same way. But we had stockpiled chemical weapons to use against the civilian population of Japan if they resisted. And that, I mean, there's a timeline of history that did not happen where conceivably, like, a lot more horrific things happened than the dropping of the atomic bombs.
And I think even without chemical weapons, an invasion of the islands was not good.
No.
For anyone at all, civilians or otherwise.
And a lot of people like to point out in the decision calculus of whether or not to drop the bomb, and that, you know, Truman had been told there were these stats of like the potential of like 500,000 Americans killed or 1 million casualties, of which, you know, many hundreds of thousands would be killed, based on what had happened in the islands we were taking. And there's a counter argument that, oh, no, that, like, the real number was far less. It's like, oh, okay, there were some people in the government that said, oh, no, the real number, they thought it was far less. And there were people in the Navy that argued, like, at this point for Japan, we could do a blockade and starve them out. We don't need to do this whatever. But the military planners for so Operation Downfall, invasion of Japan, the two components, Coronet would be the first wave of invasions in the southern islands, and then Olympic would be against Tokyo, basically landing on a plane that's right next to where Tokyo is. There was some division, like a Marine Corps division or an Army division in particular, that, like, after the first 3-4 days was not included in the planning because they assumed the casualty rate was going to be so high that it wouldn't be a functional division anymore. And what a lot of people don't realize is that, like, a lot of the, it's like, oh, well, it was the end of the war. Japan was defeated. They had hardly anything left. No, they had their armies in China that they brought back to Japan for the defense of Japan. And so that's part of that world that in the aftermath, of the war in Europe, where the war in Japan is still going on, and also the potential threat, well, not potential at that point, it was like the threat posed by the Soviet Union under Stalin, that the United States is, give us these scientists, give us these engineers that were ardent Nazis. Mm-hmm. And some of them were in the SS and worked on the worst kinds of biological and chemical weapons because we wanted to make sure that we had them and that nobody else did. And it's just like, that's grim. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And I'm like literally just like halfway through the book. And like, so I've had to take a break, but it's very enlightening and thought provoking. And so anyways, by Annie Jacobson, it is called Operation Paperclip, and it's worth a read. Wow, man, if this were a ship, I just torpedoed it. Just
so the latest Godzilla movie, Godzilla Minus One?
Why is it called that?
I don't really know.
Because I kept hearing about that, and it's like, that can't really be the name of the movie.
No, that's the name of the movie.
And what's funny is like...
Because it's like Godzilla went to a dance, and whoever he brought left.
I'm confused because like I don't pay close attention to movies, but I mean some, and I'm generally aware of what's coming out. Like, I had no idea there was a whole slew of recent Godzilla movies.
Oh yeah, they've never really stopped.
Yeah, I didn't even.
And I can tell you which ones are good or not, but this latest one, Godzilla Minus One, they're rebooting Godzilla.
Again.
Yeah.
For like the fourth, fifth time now.
Eighth.
Yeah, but they're going back to World War Two.
Okay, that's, good.
It starts
good.
During World War Two.
Good stuff. Okay.
And then it proceeds forward. And I think everyone should see it. I mean, for no other reason that it shows a snippet of what Japan was like at the end of World War II and the years afterwards in an intimate way of people really living in Japan, trying to rebuild their lives
in the rubble and death all around them,
and it was fascinating, and it's done with a lot of. I mean, it's obviously they're harking back to the old style of Japanese acting and that style of movie.
Cool,
but it's done with a lot of respect, and they're trying. You know, they have this very nice little message going on. And then they have a Godzilla movie. And I have to say, I didn't think this was possible. They made Godzilla scary again. There were literally scenes where Godzilla comes into view and I'm like, oh, fuck.
Really?
Run, people, run. Wow. You know, it's just like, and I'm both rooting for the people and Godzilla at the same time because I love Godzilla movies.
Sure. I always love Godzilla movies.
Yeah, I'm kind of a fanatic at this point, I admit it. But it was just, how do you make Godzilla scary again after years of camp? I don't know how they did it, but they pulled it off. Last call.
So we had a couple Irish whiskeys.
Mm-hmm.
We had Jameson.
Yeah.
And we had Bushmills, their 12-year, which I was introduced to the Bushmills actually on a whiskey advent calendar somebody gave me, which was just fun. Mostly for getting to try a range. I found some that were very not to my liking, but some that were really, really nice. And this was one of the ones I really, really liked. I was able to find it not without too much difficulty.
Yeah.
And I'd had a regular Bushmills years ago. I said, I need to try an Irish whiskey first time I tried one. And it was fine. It was smooth and pleasant, and it wasn't a whole lot of flavor going on. It was okay. Not remarkable. The 12-year? Oh, that's nice.
It is nice.
It's got some really neat flavors.
This is the first time I've had that, but it's going to be on my list of like sipping whiskeys to buy.
Yeah.
It's nice.
It's a pleasant one.
And so, I brought the bottle of Jameson. And I will say, I haven't actually had Jameson in about 10 years. I mean, it's been a long time. And it's very smooth. It's very, very welcoming.
Very easy. Very easy drinking.
It's like a... I don't want to If I say it's an entry level whiskey, I don't want to sound like that's disparaging, because it's not. I mean, it's a whiskey. It's an Irish whiskey. Yeah. It's like if they did Rebecca Creek in Ireland. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I do like it, but I'm going to say it tastes different than what I remember, mm-hmm. which means I don't think it tastes different. I think it just like I'm different. My taste buds are different. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's still very nice. Mm-hmm. I like having a bottle of Jameson around. Definitely going to look at keeping a bottle of that Bushmills 12 around, because that was really, really nice.
Yeah, that's a really nice one.
Let's tell the kids about the scotch.
So the scotch I picked up at the recommendation of the proprietor of the local liquor store was Aberfeldy. It's a Highland single malt. It's also 12 years in oak, which makes me point out the Bushmills 12 was aged 12 years in oak barrels. That's the whole 12. That's the year thing. That's why you get
wood is so important to whiskey.
It is. The Bushmills, they actually use three different barrels.
Well, that's energetic.
Yeah, there's a bourbon somewhere. There's two other kinds. I forget what one I think may have been a port.
I mean, the result is good, but it's a like lovely, you don't need to go through that much to be good.
That's the thing. It's like you're trying really hard here. This is very complicated.
Yeah.
This one apparently is like, no, we just stuck it in a barrel for 12 years, and they actually have like, we lose over a third to the angels.
Oh, the angel, basically, yeah, it sits
in one barrel so long, a third of it literally evaporates.
I don't know that it's such a great thing to like advertise your inefficiencies, though, you know, in your process.
Yeah, but if it's to the angels, it makes it sound better.
Showing they're doing it the old traditional way.
Yeah.
And if it ain't broke.
Which, okay, you know, but that's like, it's like your incandescent bulb saying 90% goes to the angels.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. Well, like the Bushmills doesn't, but that's because they keep rebarreling it. So they lose a bit, but then they fill it all back up in the new barrels. And so they don't notice. They're still losing the same third probably, but it doesn't sound as cool. Anyway, but yeah, no, this was just off the recommendation of the proprietor of the store. It's lovely.
It is.
It is. It is delightful. Very smooth. A lot of really neat flavor going on. Not expensive. And of course, once the dozens of listeners to our podcast get it, it'll probably get the price.
The tens of listeners.
Tens of listeners.
So when I tasted it initially, it's like, okay.
I just want to say that we love our tens of listeners.
We do.
That was and not a diss to our regular listening audience.
No,
thank you
all.
So much for coming.
Like it's not a diss to them.
It's a diss to the hundreds of millions of other people who are not followers.
Yeah, who need to be. So spread the word. But this is a scotch, this is smooth, but then there were like other tastes that hit me. And for me, I swear it tastes like peaches, which is ridiculous. Like even the smoothest, richest Highland malt is not going to taste like peaches to anybody.
He's crazy about that. It is a Highland, but yeah, I got nothing fruity or peachy about this whatsoever.
Yeah, and I'm assuming most of y'all out there in radio land won't either. But I'm just saying for me, I mean, just in case some of y'all want to like, the taste that hit me sort of like second, and then the aftertaste, it was like, this is peaches.
So peaches or not peaches aside,
it's excellent.
It's very lovely.
Yeah,
very
and not like peach schnapps.
Like real peaches.
Like peaches and wood. I don't know that that's a plus for you, but it is.
It's a whiskey. It tastes like
you
whiskey.
Just need to trust me. It's good either way.
Yeah.
Even if you don't taste peaches, it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Thumbs up.
Yep. Definitely. Two thumbs up.
So tying it back to
what an acre is.
I don't know if I can go all the way back to an acre. I was going to try to somehow go back to Whiskey Rebellion and then go from there to measures of whiskey in barrels. But I actually don't know enough about the measurement of whiskey barrels to make that connection.
No, neither. Although I know that there is like a standard barrel, a bushel, and a peck, and I have no idea what the relationship is with one
another. And I actually dug into a little more about like how many bottles in a barrel, and apparently there are dozens of kinds of barrels, and they're not entirely consistent. So
like the Troy system have a barrel? Yeah,
probably. So while there is like barrel, U.S. barrel is a certain volume. When you actually get into actual distilling, the physical barrels they use are a variety of sizes. And partly because sometimes they're not using whiskey barrels, they're using port barrels or
whatever. Yeah, and that's going to be different.
And so it's, you can't trust how big a whiskey barrel is.
Which just speaks to the importance of standardizing.
There we go.
Across nations, though, not just within a nation.
Well, you can't force nations. You can suggest, you can encourage, you can have nations decide collectively to get together and say, this is a good idea.
Agree. And I would actually argue that as long as a nation in and amongst itself establishes a standard, as long as you can convert among those standards.
Like it's the among same thing. 50 different standards?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as you can talk to each other and you know as what you're talking about convert, with a little sure. translation. Yeah. Basically the unit measure version of why can't we all just get along?
You know, I just think like I have an app on my phone that has like lots of different tools and things like that, but one of them is like convert anything to any system of measurement.
Yep. I got one of those. Those are great.
They are. That's kind of cool.
In case you want to know your speed in furlongs per fortnight.
Yeah.
And who doesn't?
Really?
I use it when I'm cooking because.
Yes.
I have British cookbooks. And
yeah.
Oh.
They're in liters, milliliters, and I'm in grams. They're
metric, yeah.
And yikes. I'm like, oh, hey.
Yeah.
How much is that in my cup?
Yeah.
We'll just get a better measuring cup that has both.
No, I actually have a little kitchen scale.
Oh, yeah. If you're doing.
See,
you're doing
and weights, yeah. I've done very little kitchening, cooking, baking.
But obviously, if you're calling it kitchening.
But I can't imagine. It's like, why would you do stuff in like liters and milliliters when you can have like a cup, a half cup, a teaspoon, a tablespoon? I mean, these are things.
Because nothing comes in cups from the grocery store.
Yeah. Cups come in cups.
No, actually, nothing comes in cups. Cups aren't cups.
How many ounces in a cup? 8 ounces. Coffee how many cup? Things? How many things come in ounces?
Coffee cup?
8 ounces, except for my coffee maker, which, by the way, suddenly defines a cup as 5 ounces, which yes. is like in what fucking universe?
In the coffee maker universe, because all coffee makers uses a cup that nobody else uses.
Yeah.
That's not, no, I've had coffee makers no. where a cup is 8 ounces.
No. They're all crazy. They're all ridiculous.
Then my life is a fucking lie.
This is what I'm saying, sir.
Can't help you there.
I'm so glad that you've joined us.
You're going to have to start measuring it by a different metric.
Oh.
You know, that didn't even warrant that, really. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate that. Thank you for your support. But
yeah, I'll cut it. Don't worry. Yeah.
Thank God. No.
May I see that scotch bottle?
Yeah. There you go.
I don't know. In a way, it's remarkable humanity ever gets anything done.
Oh, yeah.
Did you say humanity or humidity?
Humanity.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah. No, it's...
You couldn't hear me over the loudest bottle opening ever. And thank you for doing that right by the mic.
I'm sorry.
That sounded awesome.
I'm sorry. I didn't. I wasn't thinking.
Yeah. No, it is amazing that people get anything done. It really, between all of the random issues individuals have and groups of individuals have. Yeah. It's a wonder.
So here's the, what was it? Furlong and a half, a furlong and a chain.
A chain by a furlong.
Chain by a chain. Furlong.
66 feet by 660 feet is an acre.
Because why not? Because
it's so much clearer to me now than it was before.
So pint is a pound the world round.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You have been listening to Civics on the Rocks, a once-a-month podcast featuring a real engineer going by the fake name of Steve, a real history teacher going by the fake name of Mac, and a fake producer going by the real name of Ann Treminsky. That's me. The guys drop a lot of references while they talk. We've tried to document them all in order of appearance on our website at civicsontherocks.podbean.com. We're also Civics on the Rocks on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads if you want to suggest a question of the day, or cocktail recipes, or different types of media you think we should check out. Whatever, please drop by. We may also have an account on the platform formerly known as Twitter, but it's hard to tell these days. If you didn't like our podcast, Well, I doubt you're still listening. But if you are, thanks for giving it a go. We know we're not everybody's glass of iced tea. If you did like our show, please follow, review, and share. And stay tuned for our next episode next month. Until then, cheers, y'all.